relationship between language and the external world. In other words, when I say something about a tree or something like that, what's the relationship between my statement about the tree, or even the word tree, and the tree that's out there? What's the connection between the two? How does language affect thought? Okay, does my language shape the way I think, or does my thinking shape my language? What is the relationship of language to culture? How much of our culture is determined by the way we speak, by the language we speak, those kinds of things? What's the relationship of language to power? That's where you see the politically correct stuff in spades. And let me give you another hint. Postmodernism may be really big on language, but the fundamental reality to a postmodernist, at least of the sort we're talking about, postmodernism is a pretty broad thing, but the kind of postmodernists we're talking about, the fundamental reality of life, the fundamental reality of everything is power. Postmodernism is an exercise of power. That's what it's about. Okay, so let's move on. Let's take a look at where this heads. First of all, in terms of language and thought, there's this idea called linguistic relativity. It shows up in something that is labeled the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, although neither Sapir nor Whorf ever actually articulated it. And basically what this says is that language shapes thought, not the other way around. Language shapes thought, not the other way around. Now, there are two forms of this. There's a strong form, which is linguistic determinism, which means that your language determines how you think. The weak form is the language influences how you think. It doesn't determine it, but it certainly influences it. And the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is really accepted by linguists across the board. I was a linguistics major as an undergrad, and I didn't know anybody who really disagreed with this in the linguistics community. So this principle of linguistic relativity, the relationship of language to thought, is really fundamental to the field of linguistics, but it's also fundamental to postmodernism, as we will see. Keep it in mind, you'll be seeing it again. Now, the other thing we need to note at this point is Ludwig Wittgenstein, German philosopher. Not going to go into much with Wittgenstein, except one point that, again, ends up being really important for us. It comes up in his book, Philosophical Investigations. The book was written in 1946. It was published only after his death in 1953. And in this book, Wittgenstein talks about what he calls language games. He says that everything we say, everything we do for communication, is a kind of game that has its own set of rules. Now, for our purposes here, the key point is that words do not have any meaning outside of their own context. So, to put this in simple terms, if I say the word green, you have no idea what it is that I'm talking about. Do I mean a color? Do I mean the color that I see, being red, green, colorblind? Do I mean envious, green with envy? Do I mean not right? Do I mean ecologically informed and concerned and all of that? Or do I mean what I was really thinking of, my friend Rick Green? Unless you hear the word green in context, you don't know what the heck I'm talking about. That's Wittgenstein. Words only have meaning in context. And that is going to lead us, if you take that too far, which the postmodernists do, that is going to lead us into a host of problems. Okay. Now, I apologize, we've got to deal with a bunch of technical issues here. So I'm going to give you quick descriptions of a couple of other movements that were really important as we're leading into full postmodernism. The first of them is structuralism. Structuralism is actually based on linguistics. Language, you see, consists of a whole lot of interrelated and interconnecting structures. We have nouns, verbs, and adjectives. We have subjects, we have predicates. We've got prepositional phrases. We have all these various linguistic structures that interlock and interconnect and so on, and that forms our linguistic system, that forms our language. Structuralism takes that idea and says that that's how society works. Society exists as a whole bunch of interlocking and interconnecting structures. We've got all different kinds of structures in a network. Now, that point is interesting. You can buy it or not. For our purposes, the key thing within this is this idea of binary opposition. Binary opposition says, well, let's do it in linguistics first. Binary opposition says that words are typically defined in terms of their of an opposite. Now, we're not talking true opposites like up and down. We're talking opposites like good and evil. We're talking opposites like, well, they would argue male and female. So it's hard to define what male means without having a definition of female. You define the two in opposition to each other. You define good in opposition to evil, evil in opposition to good, and so on. That's binary opposition. And the structuralist says that binary opposition exists not just in language, but kind of across the board. Our definitions of words, certainly, but even things like our identity, who we think we are, we think of ourselves in opposition to something else. Okay, this is the basic concept. You don't need to worry too much about it, but you gotta get at least the general idea here. Now, structuralism generated its own reaction. It's called post-structuralism. Post-structuralism is gonna be really important for us because it's going to shape a great deal of what we see in postmodernism. So the post-structuralists typically will reject the structuralist assumption that reality or that society consists of this network of interlocking structures. With this, now, again, understand within structuralism, to understand the society, you need to understand how all these different things interconnect with each other. It is, in fact, what a philosopher would call a coherence theory of truth. That is to say, things are true if they form a coherent whole. If they explain everything and do it in a good, consistent way, it's coherent, and that is an argument that something that a statement is true or a system is true. The post-structuralists reject structuralism. And with it, they typically are also going to throw out the coherence theory of truth. Truth is not something that is coherent, that explains everything. What truth is, we'll get to in a minute. They're also, interestingly enough, going to reject experience as a criterion for truth. And by this, they mean scientific evidence, that kind of thing. With that, they are rejecting a different theory of truth called the correspondence theory. The correspondence theory says truth is that which corresponds to reality. A statement is true if it corresponds to reality. The post-structuralists will typically, with their rejection of experience, in the meaning of the word that they use, like I said, scientific evidence and things like that, and the rejection of that, they're going to also reject the coherence theory of truth. They're systematically rejecting all of the basic concepts that we use for defining truth in philosophy. Knowledge is, they're going to argue that knowledge is based, what we think of as knowledge, what we think of as truth, is based on cultural narratives, cultural assumptions. What you think of as true, what you think of as real, is a product of your culture. If you were from a different culture, you would think reality was something different. So, this means they're going to reject what they call meta-narratives. A meta-narrative is an overarching explanation of history, of society, of humanity, of human life, anything like that. There is no meta-narrative. There are a lot of narratives. Every culture has its own narrative that to them explains life, explains purpose, explains meaning, all of that. But there's no overarching. There is no universal story. There are just individual culture stories. And with this, they're also going to reject typically the concept from structuralism of binary opposition. Because you see, these binaries are themselves culturally determined. There's nothing objectively real about the binary. The reason why you need to know that is that there are people out there today who are telling you that there is no such thing as male and female, that male and female are culturally determined. That's why I'm telling you this. You need to understand this is the thinking behind statements that people make that on the surface sound utterly nonsensical. It's because they're coming out of these ideas. So what you have here in the post-structural world, which is going to become, again, foundational to postmodernism, is all of the traditional ways of determining whether something was true. Coherence theory, correspondence theory. Those are the two big ones that you'll get in any class on epistemology, the branch of philosophy dealing with knowledge. Those two things are rejected. And in fact, where this leads immediately is there is no such thing as objective truth. All truth is cultural. There is no objectivity to it. That, in turn, is going to lead to a number of other absurdities. For example, you find people, there's a field called fact studies right now. And in fact studies, they will argue that obesity is not a problem and that all of the medical evidence that indicates that obesity is a problem is culturally determined by people who are engaged in fat shaming and values, for cultural reasons, value being skinny. So you can throw out the medical evidence, it's irrelevant because it's culturally determined. That is where this goes. And there are people who are making that argument seriously. There are actually journals of fat studies. So, this, again, this is abstract stuff. It seems a little weird for good reason. It's kind of complicated, but you need to at least have a general idea of this if you're going to make sense of some of the absurdities that are going on right now, culturally and politically. Okay, let's move on to some specific examples. Jacques Derrida. Derrida is a French philosopher, was a French philosopher. He is the really probably the key figure in a movement called deconstructionism. And Derrida got there from kind of an odd route, if you're familiar at all with deconstructionism. But let's walk through this. Again, complex thinker, there's a lot more that could be said. I'm trying to pinpoint the things that are most important for our purposes here. Derrida is going to start as a structuralist. He's going to start with the idea of binary opposition, but he's going to add an extra wrinkle to it. He's going to say that in every binary, there is a hierarchy. One is superior to the other. So, male and female. Being male is better than being female, culturally. Good and evil. Good is superior to evil, and so on. Every binary, and these are just sort of obvious big examples, but every binary has with it an implicit hierarchical relationship. One is superior, is above, it's ahead of the other. Deconstructionism, then, is built on that basic idea. What he says we need to do is look at all of these binaries that we have, all these binary opposition things that we've got in our language, in our culture, and so on. And we have to deconstruct them. We have to identify what the binary is. We have to identify the hierarchy that is implicit in that binary, and we need to question it. We need to undermine it. We need to dismantle it. That's the core of what deconstructionism is about. It has massive political implications because the whole thing fundamentally revolves around this idea of disrupting or dismantling hierarchies. So any hierarchical situation needs to be deconstructed, not just in terms of our words, definitions, and things like that, but in practical terms as well. Thus, there are people who have authority over other people. That is a hierarchical relationship. We need to disrupt that. We need to dismantle it. Now, Derrida doesn't go there directly. He talks in terms of what he calls texts. Now, to you or me, the word text means something that is written. To Derrida, anything can be a text. Spoken language, written language, but not just languages. Law codes are texts. Films are texts. Relationships between people are texts. All of these things are texts. And all these texts carry with them these binary, oppositional binaries, and every one of them needs to be dismantled. Now, Derrida doesn't go here, but other people who get involved in deconstruction are actually going to take this in other, you know, they're going to push this further. One of the key areas you see this in is the clearest example would be in the Bible. It's not just the Bible, but anything else as well. Authorial intent. What did the writer intend to say? That has been the foundation for hermeneutics, for biblical interpretation, for centuries, trying to figure out authorial intent. If deconstructionism is true, if this is actually the program, then number one, we can't really get to authorial intent because we don't live in the same context as the author. We can't really understand exactly what he meant. But even if he or she, but even if we could, it would be irrelevant because the author's intent is just one possible meaning of the text. When you read it, you're going to almost certainly get a different meaning than the author had, and your meaning from that text is just as valid as the author's. So authorial intent goes out the wall, out the window. And as a result, you can take the Bible and you can make it say whatever it is you think it means. Now, this doesn't only apply to the Bible. I read a story about Isaac Asimov one day, who was visiting a university, and there was someone who was lecturing on one of Asimov's short stories, or short story collections. And Asimov sat in on the lecture, and the guy got it. The guy just got it all wrong. I mean, it's just crazy what he did with it. And Asimov went up to him afterwards and said, you really didn't understand that story at all. And he said, well, how do you know? And he said, I wrote it. And the professor said, so what? That doesn't matter. Because authorial intent is only one meaning. And any other reading of it is just as valid as the author's intent. It's not just the Bible, it's atheists like Asimov. This is what's known, this leads into something called reader response criticism. The basic idea being the response of the reader to the text is what you need to pay attention to, not the text itself. Now, I'm giving you this in relatively simple terms. The other thing you frankly need to know, I would wish my worst enemy to read Derrida or any of these other deconstructionists. The stuff is laden with so much jargon that it is absolutely impenetrable. I remember at one point I was on the job market. So you have to attend the American Historical Association, at least in that period. You have to go there because that was where all the job interviews were done. And I remember it was just before lunch and I was by the desk seeing if anybody actually wanted to talk to me. And they were doing a session on postmodern history right next door. And I figure I should probably at least get some exposure to this. So I walked into the room and I sat and I listened to this lecture. Now, I'm a reasonably bright person. I was completing a PhD in history. I did not understand a single sentence that this person said. And because it was so laden with this, larded over with this jargon. Oh, I can't say that, that's that shaming. It was so encrusted, let's use that word, with this jargon that it was absolutely, you know, and I'm sitting there, I'm listening to these people, I'm watching these people in the room, sitting there nodding sagely as this guy's going on and on, and I'm convinced that they were thinking about what they were going to be having for lunch, because there's no way they could have understood what this guy was talking about. Okay. So you need to be aware of this. What I'm trying to do here is give you some of the core ideas, once again, that you need to be aware of as we're moving forward. One other guy, Michel Foucault. I want you to note, by the way, that both Derrida and Foucault are French. And the reason why that's important is right now, in France, there are people who are making arguments that American academia is a danger to French culture. The ideas coming out of American universities are a danger to French culture and French intellectual life. It started there. Okay, but anyway, Michel Foucault. Foucault and Derrida didn't get along. He really didn't like Derrida at all. He started off in the New Left, interestingly enough, but he really got disillusioned by it. He really didn't like the program and the way things were advancing there. And Foucault developed sort of an alternative way of thinking about this that's different from what we saw in the New Left and cultural Marxism in the last lecture. Foucault was really focused in around the relationship of power, knowledge, and language. So the basic idea here is that objective knowledge, once again, you can't get there. There is no such thing as objective knowledge. All knowledge is cultural. He's going to accept that concept. So the question then is, who controls the culture? Well, the answer, a very Gramscian New Left answer, is that the people with cultural power, the elites, control the culture. The people with cultural power control the culture. Therefore, the people with cultural power determine what qualifies as knowledge. This is an application of Gramsci's idea of the hegemony, the cultural hegemony, the elites controlling the culture. Okay. That determines what is acceptable as knowledge, or what is accepted as knowledge. So knowledge and power are intimately connected. Power determines what qualifies as knowledge. Further, according to Foucault, language is a tool for encoding these power structures. Language itself develops in a way and is controlled, again, by the elites, providing the definitions and all of that kind of thing and the usage of it, that is put in place to keep the elites in power. So language is a tool for the hegemony. It is a tool for maintaining the existing power structures in society. So knowledge, language, and power all go together. And fundamentally, power is the central fact. Now, Foucault is also going to apply this into the area of sexuality. He's going to see sex and sexuality as social constructs. To the best of my knowledge, he's the first person who's going to go quite in this direction. Sex and sexuality are social constructs, and frankly, they are once again a means that those in power use to maintain their own power. Basically, his argument would be that the standard traditional picture of male and female, husband and wife, marriage, sexuality in that kind of a context, all of that is a tool for maintaining the power of the people who are in control, who are in charge. It has no basis in objective reality. And thus, it is used, the language and the structures we have related to sexuality are used to delegitimize people who don't fit into these norms, specifically the LGBT community. Foucault is going to see all of this stuff as a tool to maintain the power of the existing power structures, and in order to do that, you need to shut down LGBT stuff. That's Foucault's argument. Obviously, there's a whole lot more to that, but for our purposes, that's far enough. Let's move to the next one, because now we've got the pieces in place to actually get to full-blown cultural Marxism. Excuse me, full-blown critical theory. Critical theory is the result of the union of cultural Marxism with these specific postmodern trends that I just talked about. You have Gramsci's idea of a cultural hegemony and the call for a counter-hegemony. In other words, the people with cultural power, worldview, all of that sort of thing, on the one hand, we need a counter to that. That's part of critical theory. The New Left's idea of oppressed classes and identity politics is part of critical theory. Derrida's challenge of hierarchies is part of critical theory. And Foucault's concept of the power dynamics of language, that language is about power fundamentally, is also part of this. Now the irony, of course, once again, is that Foucault rejected the New Left, but what he's doing with these ideas is playing right into it. Now, what you see here, once again, I started with the statement that postmodernism really centers around language. Language is a critical focus within postmodern thought. And the reason for that should be obvious coming out of Foucault. And going back to linguistic relativity, the idea of the relationship of language and thought. Language is a tool of the hegemony. It is a tool of the cultural elites to maintain their own power. Therefore, language must also be a tool of the counter-hegemony. If we are going to take down the oppressive power structures that exist in society, we need to harness language to do it. Just like language upholds the existing power structures, we need to restructure language so that it will tear them down. We'll see some specific examples of this as we go along, but if you give it a moment's thought, I'm sure you can come up with several of your own. Once again, this idea goes back to linguistic relativity. Language shapes thought. And as a result, if you want to change society, one of the critical routes you've got to use to do this is to change your language. Therefore, we get political correctness. Think about it like this. When I was growing up, there were a number of terms that were used to describe African Americans that were perfectly acceptable. And to demonstrate they're perfectly acceptable, I'm going to give you some examples. The word Negro, don't use that anymore. Until you get to the United Negro College Fund.
Yeah.
Colored people. Oh, we can't use that unless you actually know what the NAACP stands for. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. When those organizations were started, those were considered acceptable terms. However, as the New Left is beginning to push racial ideas, as we're getting some of these linguistic ideas coming in as well, the idea is that if you use a term that is intrinsically prejudicial, you are simply encoding racism into the system. Therefore, we are going to look for an alternative word to Negro or colored person or whatever, to eliminate the possibility of prejudice. We're going to find a good neutral word that we can use. Therefore, the old terms, which were part of the hegemony, become unacceptable. So instead of Negro, we are going to use black. But here's the problem. Black has negative connotations in our language. And further, they're not all black. Duke Ellington wrote a piece called Black, Brown, and Beige. So black isn't really an adequate word. We'll switch it to Afro-American. But then Afro-American got rejected for some reason. I suspect because as people were using it, they weren't seeing prejudice declining. So then it switched to African-American. Then it went back to black, and then it got African-American. It sort of oscillates between the two. Both of those are now more or less acceptable. What's going on there? What's going on there is an attempt to find language that will prevent you from having negative views of that race. Now, understand, let me be very clear about this. If you have negative views of black people, you got a serious problem, and you are going to need to talk to God about that. And I mean that very literally. You'll see why tomorrow. I am not in any way trying to justify bigotry or prejudice. What I'm doing is giving you a concrete illustration of how the language, these ideas about language, play themselves out in the culture. So, language relates to power, relates to, well, ultimately what we're really dealing with is an attempt at mind control. If I can get you to use the right language, I can control what you think. Now, I don't actually believe that's true, but that's how they're thinking here. Another part of this then, and again, if you think about what we said about the New Left and postmodernism, you can see how this grows out of it. Another component of this is intersectionality. Now, intersectionality begins with approved categories of oppression. I want you to pay close attention to that phrase, approved categories. Because it turns out that there are some categories of oppression that are more equal than others. The way intersectionality works is you start with the earliest one is going to be race, then you're going to add sex or gender, then you're going to add LGB, and then you're going to add T. There are others as well, but let's just work with these. So, here's the problem. If you are a person of color, another relatively neutral term for non-whites, up to a point. If you are a person of color, you are facing prejudice of various sorts. You are facing kinds of oppression. If you are a woman, you are facing kinds of oppression as well. Let's just leave it at those two. Suppose this is the way intersectionality works. How do these various categories of oppression relate to each other? If you are a black, you experience oppression as a black. If you are a woman, you experience oppression as a woman. If you are a black woman, you experience oppression both as a black and as a woman and as a black woman. There are special areas of prejudice that hits you or oppression that hits you by fitting into that intersectional category. So the term intersectionality is originally used as a way of trying to analyze and, if you will, quantify the degree of oppression different people experience as a result of belonging to one of these approved categories of oppression. Now again, notice the word approved here. Once again, they're not concerned about economic status. They don't really care much about the coal miner in Appalachia. Not an issue for them. It's not one of the approved categories. So, that when we talk about intersectionality, when a postmodernist or critical theory person talks about intersectionality, that's what they're looking at. However, it turns out that although the term intersectionality is not used often in this context, it also has another meaning within critical theory. And that's your intersectionality ties into your identity, who you are. Now, The weird thing about critical theory is traditionally we have understood things either in terms of universals, what is universally true about humanity, let's just leave it at that level, or particulars, what is true about you as a specific individual. Critical theory rejects both of these. There is no such thing as a universal human nature. There is no universal that affects all of humanity. Again, there's no meta-narrative. There's no overarching story about humanity. And there are no universals. Everything about you is culturally determined. So how can there be a universal? But at the same time, you don't really exist as an individual. What you are is the product of all your various intersectional categories. I am a white, male, cisgender, heterosexual, probably a few others we can throw in as well. And everything about me is determined by all of these categories that I'm part of. The intersection of all of those categories results in me. There's nothing specific about me that really is important. I am my intersectional identity. Now, why is that important? One of the things that you will see this particularly when we're dealing with critical race theory, is they will draw a distinction. Critical race theorists, not all of them, but many of them, will draw a distinction between being a black person and a person who happens to be black. The way that works out is if you take, oh, let's say Clarence Thomas, or you know, any other obviously very successful person who is black in American culture, who has excelled in their field, as long as it is in sports. That person is going to have a lot of characteristics that, as we'll see tomorrow, are associated with whiteness. They are thus a person who happens to be black. They are not a true black person. Because a black person is a person who has the full experience and outlook that comes from the approved intersectional categories. You're not an individual. You can't say that Clarence Thomas got where he is because he worked hard, because he had this particular set of values and applied them. You can't go there because there is no individual, there's only an intersectional identity. And he doesn't fit the proper form of the intersectional identity, so he's not a true black person. Okay. So intersectionality fits in with identity. Like I said, literally everything about you is determined, in critical theory at least, is determined by your intersectional identity. By the way, I just have to add this. There is a university in Oregon that determined that because Slavic immigrants into that area had been abused and mistreated, that Slavs qualified as persons of color, not as white persons. I'm a Slav. There are other schools, there are other places. This just came up this week. I think it might have been in California. They're increasingly moving Asians out of persons of color category into white categories because their achievements are too high and excuse the statistics. Now, again, this all ties in with this idea of intersectional identities. if you do not fit the program that they say must occur as part of the intersectional identity as a person of color, then you can't be a person of color. You're a person who happens to be black. Or you're an Asian who is actually really white, not Asian. It works the other way around too. If you happen to be white, but don't fit the pattern, the stereotype they have of what it means to be white, you're Slavic, then you're not really white, you're a person of color. This is really weird stuff, but this is the way it works. This is what happens when you have a worldview that is essentially, well, if I can reference Greek mythology, that's not inappropriate. It's a Procrustean bed. Procrustes was a guy who had an iron bed in Greek mythology, and he said that this bed would fit everybody. And if you lay down on the bed and were too big, he would cut off whatever hung off. And if you were too small, he would stretch you to make you fit. Critical theories of Procrustean bed. One other element for tonight, and then we'll call it an evening, standpoint theory. This is really a consequence of what I just told you about intersectionality. Standpoint theory says that what you think of as knowledge, your knowledge, is a product, like everything else about you, is a product of your intersectional identity. Okay. So, what this means is that anything that we might use as a normal criterion for truth, let's say statistics, scientific evidence, whatever, that itself is a product of a white intersectional identity. It therefore is only valid, if it's valid at all, in white cultures. We're seeing in, I believe it's Washington State right now, the argument that mathematics is white and we need to decolonize mathematics. All knowledge is a product of your intersectional identity. And there is no objectivity. Remember, objectivity is out. So science can't be objective. Science itself must be a product of, well, white identity. What this means then is that if you are non-white, if you are in a culture that does not value or work with science or what have you, then that is perfectly fine because no identity, no intersectional identity is theoretically superior to any other. No culture is superior to any other. So whatever your culture sees as a means of knowledge is as valid as anything white culture sees as a means. Specifically, this means experience. In the case of America, this is how this works out specifically. Your experience is a valid means of knowledge. And experience for a person of color, experience is self-validating and it is self-interpreting. What you experience, how you experience, and how you interpret it is all automatically perfectly true, perfectly valid, and just as good as any other evidence someone might appeal to. This leads to what Vodi Bakum, if you don't know Vodi, you need to. Look him up on YouTube, watch everything you can find from Vodi Bakum. What Vodi says, he calls this ethnic Gnosticism. And the way this works, so for example, I say something that I do not mean in any way to be offensive. I do not actually think anything racist as I'm saying this. But if a person of color hears me say it and interprets it as racist, it's racist. Vodi Bakum calls this ethnic Gnosticism. as a member of this ethnic group, you have a secret knowledge where you can identify what is truly racist, even if the person has no conscious racial intent, racist intent. You can identify this. Because experience is just as good as a criterion for truth as statistics, scientific evidence, as intention, or anything else. Now, this then leads you to another point. Since we live in a white culture, since we live in a culture that is dominated by whiteness, which is actually a technical term that they use, we live in a culture that's dominated by whiteness, people who are white just really experience their own culture. They just go through life and they have their own normal experiences, and that's it. But people of color have to function, they have to learn how to function in white culture, but they also have experiences within their own culture that are going to be different from the experiences of whites. As a result, they have two cultures to draw from in their understanding of the world, at least two, whereas whites only have one. That means that people of color automatically have advantages in terms of wisdom, in terms of understanding of the world than whites do. Now, if you have any question about whether or not that is a real thing, I would encourage you to think about Sonia Sotomayor, a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, who said, "I would hope that a wise Latina woman, with the richness of her experience," note the richness of her experience, "would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life." She said that actually at a confirmation hearing, if I remember right. That's standpoint theory in a nutshell. So the point is that, you know, I've given you multiple examples as we've gone through this. This stuff is, I would basically say, omnipresent. The kind of thinking that we're talking about here, and again, I can give multiple other kinds of examples, but the kind of thinking that we're talking about here is everywhere. I guarantee if you send your kids to the public school, they're getting this. It is moving into churches. It is already in place on the Supreme Court. It is everywhere in media. It is, well, you can't avoid it. I can give you example after example after example. This is the water in which our country is swimming. This is the dominant worldview in America now, in one form or another. And to give you a preview of coming attractions, critical theory functions as an umbrella under which lots of, well, I would call them sub-worldviews or worldview stems fit in. Much of, well, critical race theory is an obvious one. LGBTQ+ is an obvious one. There's a lot of feminism that falls under this category. Even radical environmentalism. Because in radical environmentalism, the earth is the oppressed class. This is why so many of these disparate groups that seem to have nothing in common, it's why they work together. Because underlying their own individual causes is a much, much broader ideology that informs their own worldview, informs their own cause, but also in a true New Left fashion leads them to make common cause with other oppressed groups with the goal of undermining and replacing, ultimately, the system. So, like I said, if you want to understand the major worldview competitor Christians are facing, this is it. And like I said, it's got a lot of subforms that we could talk about, and in fact, tomorrow morning, we will be doing that. But for now, like I said, these are the I would say, the core points that I would want to make sure you're at least exposed to. I know this has gone pretty fast, and there's a lot of stuff, and a lot of it is pretty weird and pretty abstract. But you need to at least be aware of these things so that you can make sense of what's to come. So, thank you.
I'm at a disadvantage because I can't see everybody. I have a granddaughter that just graduated in biology. Is she in the room? If I brought her up here, she would explain to you that you don't get biology by listening to the lecture. You go back and study it, and you start to put the pieces together. 11 years ago, I had a vision, and it was like, I don't mean the literal vision, but you know what I mean. My vision was that we would have a lecture series like you do at a university. Now, I know some of you are red meat people, and I love you, but I'm not a red meat person. What you've heard tonight, if you dissect each one of these things, they're not hard to understand. The challenge is, like biology, starting to put it all together and understand what makes the whole system function. And so, by the grace of God, I think we're going to have this. We will have the PowerPoint presentations up. We will have the audios up. With a little luck, we'll have the videos up too. So you're not going to get this all in one piece. I mentioned Nancy Piercy's book on Total Truth. How many times have you read that book? Yeah. You don't put these systems together in 15 minutes. If you're going to be, and what we're all about, we hope, is being an equipping center. That's what we want to do, is equip people. You don't get equipped by red meat stuff. You get equipped by putting the pieces together. And so I'm going to challenge you to go home, listen to this again, and come tomorrow, because it's going to make more and more sense as you put these pieces together. If you're reading books that you understand and you get it all, David, the first time you read it, how many of those books you did not many, do you? If you're reading those kinds of books, you're wasting your mind. You need to be reading stuff and listening to stuff that stretches you. You don't get it the first time, because you may understand the little pieces, but you can't put it together. Put this together, because he is right. And Lynn, you have trained him well. So we have time for two questions, but before you have to leave.